welcome to your new life and our new times in what has been labeled as humanity's greatest leap in evolution. Dr. K is here to assist you with holistic tips and tools, clearings and activations for your vibrational upgrade. Dr. Allison J. K. has been working as an energy medicine practitioner for 20 years, having lived in Asia for 10 years to study subtle energy. People refer to Dr. K. as the lightning bolt due to the high voltage of the work she does on behalf of assisting you to thrive in mind, body, and spirit. That is the greatest backdrop to life on planet Earth right now.
We are so blessed today to have the presence with us of Dr. B. Allen Wallace. He has been one of my teachers, actually, and I am so excited to share his wisdom and insight with you all. You're going to gain much, so sit back and get ready. And one of the things that I'm going to call him Allen, I've been given permission by him upon my request or asking how do I refer to him, so he's instead of Dr. Wallace, going with Allen, his first name. And so Dr. B. Allen Wallace comes to us from Santa Barbara. He has taken time out of his silent retreat to be with us in feeling the, I don't mean to speak for him, but he seemed to say yes to this, feeling or sensing the importance of it. And I have quoted Dr. B. Allen Wallace in my book that just got released last month, What If There's Nothing Wrong, because of his extensive and unique positioning in understanding science as well as the mind. He spent 14 years as a monk, a Tibetan Buddhist monk, and he was ordained by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. He's worked with the Dalai Lama, translating for him, I believe. And what allowed him to do that is he has an undergraduate degree from Amherst College, and I went to UMass Amherst, so we're from the Happy Valley there, the Pioneer Valley in Western Mass, the Berkshires. Both of us hail from that same area for college studies. His undergraduate is in physics and the philosophy of science, and that's going to be important. And then the doctorate work that he did was at Stanford in comparative religions. So he has a background in education and training as a scientist, and at the same time, the philosophy of scientists very much informed his studies of physics, and then his work himself personally, experientially, with working with the mind and consciousness. So he comes to us from a very unique perspective. He also leads retreats in Thailand. He's taught around the world. He's based in some of the year in Santa Barbara, and he has a Santa Barbara Institute of Consciousness Studies where they hold retreats and he teaches. I've taught with his material to my students of meditation and students of psychology. So we welcome and are honored to have B. Allen Wallace with us. Thank you, sir.
I'm glad to join you, Allison. Thanks for having me on.
Actually, one of my Reiki clients back in Taiwan, another expat, American expat, who then went on to become a yoga teacher, taught at the same school as me in India, just the next session of teachings and trainings. She was a student of yours when you were teaching at UC Santa Barbara in religion, comparative religion. Chris Wittala. Ellen and I were talking right before the show came on about how much working with the mind allows us to have a trump card, if you will, of being able to move consciousness more effectively and efficiently in the direction of our desires. So the name of the show is Create Your Best Life Ever, What Else is Possible, and we're going to find out. So why, if we refine our mind and work with our mind, Allen, does that help us have some sort of ability to work over, above, and beyond the material?
Well, I think we can start with our experience prior to engaging in any kind of rigorous cultivation, refinement, purification of the mind, basically the undisciplined mind. And I think it's obvious to us from our own experience and perhaps observing the experience of other people that when the mind really isn't cultivated, we can be very much the victims of physical circumstances, of our bodies, of the physical environment, and so forth. The mind can be like a ship that just goes with the winds of whatever's happening in the material world. And especially if we think that the mind is just physical, if we're under that delusional concept, then that can make us all the more just vulnerable, or one could say just disempowered, by letting the material just take over. So this is, I think, one great area of opportunity, let's say, in the modern world. While we already have such a wide array of methods, of exercises for developing optimal performance of the body, for developing excellent, superb physical health, stamina, vitality, endurance, and so forth, you know, we have nothing comparable in the modern education system for developing optimal performance of the mind. And so where that starts, I believe, is number one, seeing the importance of cultivating, refining, really learning how to use the mind in an optimal way, and then finding effective methods for doing so. So the cultivation of attention is a really good place to start.
You say meditation is making the mind serviceable. Alan, I use that in almost every meditation yoga class I teach. How is meditation making the mind serviceable? Because if we don't meditate, how is the mind not serviceable?
Well, I think if we take a very simple exercise, and that is if people listening should try to do a very simple task, let's say just follow their in and out breath for, let's say, 30 seconds continuously. Don't think about anything else, just observe the in-breath, the out-breath. A lot of people may be surprised that however intelligent they may be, well-educated, highly trained they may be, a simple exercise like this of sustaining unbroken, continuous, focused, clear attention for 30 seconds, a minute, let alone longer, is beyond their ability. And so we're living in something of an ADHD world, that is a world that is dominated just overall, not just by the clinically diagnosed mental problem of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, but with the pace of life, the bombardment of sensory stimuli, the information glut, the workaholic way of life that has become so common, and then the pace of entertainment, which is so frenetic, all of this, the whole way of life, the surrounding, the work, entertainment, and so forth, seems almost as if it's designed to create as much chaos in the mind as possible. So attention deficit and hyperactivity have become really much more the norm rather than simply something that is clinically diagnosed for some portion of the population. So this wasn't always the case. If one goes to traditional cultures, nomadic Tibet 67 years ago, or even out in the outback of Tibet nowadays, and other very, very traditional cultures, one sees that the whole way of life, the environment, it's much more grounded, it's quieter. It's not necessarily better, but it's better in this way. So in order to try to balance out the kind of the centrifuge of modern living that tends to cause us to be so scattered, the first thing, to my mind, or at least one very helpful entry into the cultivation of the mind, is to develop attention skills. And very briefly put, it's first of all learning how to deeply relax in body and mind, so you're very much at ease in your skin, in your mind, in your body. And then secondly, to develop a continuity, an inner quiet, a calm, a stillness of the mind. And then on that basis, see about refining the clarity, the acuity, the brilliance of awareness. And with those three qualities, relaxation, stability, and vividness, the mind can be wonderfully serviceable, and it can be used then for a wide variety of endeavors, spiritual, practical, all types of activities.
Yeah, you were teaching, one of the videos that you have coming out of your teachings of meditation I used, and it was a 3-day weekend, I believe, Alan, and in the first day you had a light meeting with the group and just let them relax and unwind from their normal day-to-day, and you were very clearly not working on the stability and vividness of the mind until the second day. Why did you need that kind of time? Because of what you were just saying, how hyper our world is and how it feeds us to be coming from an ADD, ADHD mind?
Well, you know, we in the modern world, we tend to be, and this is modern world is now everywhere. It's around the world. It's not east versus west or west versus east. We tend to be very goal-driven, a lot of very ego-centered, high desire, high attachment-driven type of activity. So when we want to achieve something, we contract, we focus, and then we surge ahead trying to accomplish the goal. if one approaches meditation with this, with a very ego-centered, but strongly effortful approach, the chances are extremely high that the approach will be one of constriction, that is, will tighten up to get the job done, no pain, no gain type of attitude.
What a great way to put it.
If one brings this to meditation, the very, very short-term results may be, hey, I got really focused. And then you just wait a little bit longer and say, yeah, I got focused. And I also got totally drained, exhausted, fatigued. And so, again, we in the modern world, in contrast to many much more traditional, slower-paced societies, we in the modern world, I believe, really need to first of all learn how to relax, but relax without getting dopey, without losing clarity of mind. And so there is the balance of relax more and more deeply, but sustain the kind of the normal level of clarity, of wakefulness that you have. And with that deeper sense of ease, then you're in a position to further cultivate the attention in terms of stability and vividness.
Do you want to talk about what vividness it means?
Sure. Vividness can be understood in various ways. Let's say a television screen, one of these modern flat screens, then we can say, well, what's vividness here? And one could say, well, number one, of course, high definition or high resolution. The screen should also be very, very bright, have very bright, vivid images, and also have very sharp contours, that is, have sharp focus, not be fuzzy. So taking that as an analogy, just as we know in dreams, some dreams can be rather vague, amorphous, and some dreams are so realistic we're sure that we're awake. And such dreams that are highly vivid have exactly those three qualities. There's a sharp focus to everything, a lot of brightness, and high definition. Everything you see, you touch, you hear, taste, and so forth has such high resolution. There's such acuity there that, of course, how can you not mistake this for waking reality? But these are qualities that can be cultivated. And so the stillness of attention is the ability to sustain voluntarily one's focus upon any given object, whether it's a mental object, a visual, auditory, and the vividness is this high resolution that brings the brightness, the acuity of awareness to whatever we're attending to.
So one of the ways that I explain the goals of meditation is that vividness and clarity happens after, I have found the same thing in my 20 years of being a meditator and the 14 years of teaching meditation. The first level is the cognitive functions get improved, like you're saying, the attentional focusing. And I love the terminology you use. It's very precise to describe the actual effects of the meditation practice. It's one of the major things I appreciate about your work, Alan. Thank you for that. And then you seem to also, we're parallel here, because I noticed that at the second level, so there is studies, and I talk about this in my book, neuroscientific studies that show after 12 minutes of meditation, the anterior cingulate is activated in the brain. Other than that, it doesn't get activated, and it's the part of our brain that gives us the ego separateness. And then once it gets activated, we have the unity feeling flooding through our brain and experience, and so in our body and mind beyond the brain. But 12 minutes of us doing the attention focusing, that first level, brings cognitive improvement quickly with the data recall, the memory recall, and then that second level, once we get into like the second chunk of time spent meditating, both in a 30-minute session and in our years of meditation, the second level seems to be this vividness, this clarity, where we start to have a sense of calm and peace, where it's alive and awake and alert, as you're explaining. And then that third level seems to be where we touch into consciousness and the power of consciousness. Do you want to talk about that a bit more, the consciousness part, the power of it?
Sure, but just to kind of give a little bit of a run-up, and that is in terms of this sequence that I found so useful in my own practice and in teaching others, first of all, the relaxation so that we mellow out, and then on that basis, then bring in a bit of discipline, a bit of effort to sustain the continuity of attention. Because again, as I mentioned earlier, if one goes for the continuity, the sustained focus, without first of all relaxing and learning how to relax more deeply, and that sustained focus is bound to give rise to greater and greater tightness and fatigue. And likewise, if it goes for vividness first and says, oh, never mind that relaxation, never mind the inner calm and stillness, I want the vividness, I want the high of high resolution, bright awareness. Well, you may be able to get it for short periods, but it's also all likelihood going to make you hypersensitive, and therefore not at your optimal performance. So with this sequence of relaxation, then the stability, then the vividness, now you have a mind that is serviceable for all types of endeavors, and I have my own mind from my perspective, in terms of my own value. I see nothing of great importance than a serviceable mind that is relaxed, stable, and clear to investigate, to explore the very nature of consciousness, its potential, its origin, to really know what is this mental phenomenon, which is still remains such a mystery. The modern science, very good reason, the modern mind sciences are almost entirely confined to studying the brain, which is not consciousness, to studying behavior, which is not consciousness, and listening to verbal reports of other people, but of course that's not consciousness either. So for all other branches of science, they're driven by very empirical, sophisticated ways of observing the phenomena that the scientists are seeking to understand, and not just things that are somehow associated with the phenomena that they're trying to understand. It's only when it comes to the mind that science, which is so fixated on the objective, has still failed to come with any really sophisticated way of introspectively observing states of consciousness, memories, dreams, and so forth. And so this area was tremendous potential for not competition, but rather collaboration between the great contemplative traditions of the world, which have developed such refined techniques, modern science, which has such rigor when it comes to studying the objective, the physical, and the quantifiable. So there's great potential there.
So speaking of that, so you segue now into science, and I love that description he gave, don't y'all, of the mind, stable, vivid, and clear. Did I restate that accurately?
Well, relaxed, first of all, relaxed, and then stable, and then finally clear and vivid, yeah.
Yeah, and I just want to say this before we move into science, too, because one of the things that I've been distinguishing in the last bunch of years in my practice and then in teaching others is it's not that we're meditating to come out of our bodies and to go off into a daydream. It's that we're meditating to be in our bodies with more aliveness, alertness, stability, vividness, and clarity and relaxation, as you're saying. And it seems to be some sort of common need that people have when they go to meditation class, just like an everyday person coming off the streets wanting more relaxation in their lives. So they show up to a yoga studio, take a yoga and meditation class, and they expect to be able to dream or daydream or relax going out into their mind instead of coming down into the body and actually making the mind more vivid, clear, and stable. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think there are sequences there. It just doesn't work out to try to bypass the body and say, never mind the body, I just want to go to the mind. Even the Buddha, you know, for 6 years he engaged in austerity, trying to, you know, kind of go around the body. And in so doing, he really let his body become depleted, emaciated, weak, and so forth, and found, hey, this is an extreme. So he restored his health, ate healthy food, and then with his physical health restored, then he was able to go on and make, I think, extraordinary discoveries about the nature of the mind. But if all one wants to do is daydream, then you don't need to go to a yoga class or a meditation class. You can stay home and do that on your own.
So it's an aspect of we're training the mind. There's a sense of discipline here, and that's the point that I want to pull out here.
This is right, yeah. And once again, I think the whole issue of sequence, that there's a certain organic development of one's attention skills. And, of course, meditation isn't just about mindfulness, just about attention. It also is really the Sanskrit word for that we translate as meditation is bhavana. And bhavana means to cultivate. So if we think of meditation as not something esoteric for the elite few, for especially spiritual people, but if we think of meditation much more broadly as the cultivation of the heart and mind, then one sees this is very, very broad. It intersects deeply with education. It has to do with cultivating empathy, emotional balance, attention skills, memory, creativity, analytical abilities, and so forth. So broadly speaking, meditation is really, I mean, the practice of meditation is really the core to cultivating our humanity, to tapping as deeply as possible into our human nature, into the very potentials of consciousness, and learning what it is to be alive in this universe.
Oh, that's so beautifully put. I love how succinctly you put such big, complex ideas. I admire that in you, and I strive. Well, I seem to do that myself without striving, too, because I don't tend to strive. That's an old paradigm word. So speaking of paradigms, you did a really great job helping me understand how Western science ended up focusing on the physical and the material and the consciousness behind. Can you talk about that a little bit more? Because you then went from your science, if I have the sequence of your events, and you might want to talk about this first. What made you go from science? Was it from science in your to religion, to meditation, to Buddhism?
You know, I stepped out of Western academia when I was 21. I was on a track for to pursue a career in science. But I found that in my studies, this was in biology, there was really nothing for my inner life to find greater meaning in my life, to explore my own potentials, to find greater satisfaction. And so I left, and for 14 years, I stepped out of Western civilization, immersed myself in Tibetan culture. As you mentioned before, I became a Tibetan Buddhist monk. But after 14 years out, really living in another culture and then living for years in solitary meditative retreat, I felt now it's time to integrate. I was 34 at the time. Come back to my own culture and see if I can make sense of both of these cultures, the traditional Tibetan culture, its deep spirituality, with the modern culture in which I've been raised in Europe and in North America. And so I thought, well, what's the paradigm of modernity? And it is science. It's what is unique. Most importantly, what is unique about modern culture is science associated with technology. And within science, it's pretty clear that the paradigm and the initial science in the whole evolution of modern science is physics. So I said, okay, let's go to the core. So this is what brought me back to academia. As you mentioned before, I went to Amherst College, spent 2.5 wonderful years there studying physics, philosophy of science, and so forth. But I wanted to really go to the kind of the paradigm of modern Western knowledge, which has now become global because, of course, science is a global phenomenon, and to look very briefly at the history of it. And that is, to my mind, the first truly great full-fledged scientist was not Copernicus, but rather Galileo, who was not only a mathematician like Copernicus, but was also a keen observer, an experimenter, developed his own technology, the telescope, and so forth and so on. And his attention, like that of later generations of these natural philosophers, which we now call scientists, his attention, although he was a devout Christian, scientifically, his attention was focused on the outer world, the external, the physical, the objective, the quantifiable. And there was a very good reason for that. He, like virtually all of the pioneers of modern science, right through into the 19th century, he was a profoundly religious person. He was Christian, like virtually all of them were. And he stated that his motivation for wanting to understand the objective physical universe was to know the mind of the Creator by way of the creation. So it was really a religious quest to know God not by looking within, as contemplatives in the Christian tradition had done for centuries before him, but rather to try to fathom the mind of God by way of his creation. And so this brought his attention, and for the last 400 years, the attention of the whole scientific tradition out to the physical, the objective, the quantifiable world. And they've done, over these 400 years, they've had a terrific success in so many fields. And then, of course, not only in terms of acquiring greater and greater knowledge, vastly expanding the horizons of the natural world, but also the many benefits of technology. So it's been a terrific success. Now, if we compare the trajectory of modern science over the last 400 years with what has happened with religion, well, religion in the medieval period, in the Renaissance, was still, in part, a pursuit of knowledge, of knowing the mind of God. So there was knowledge there, and philosophy also. We go back to Socrates, to Plato. That was also about knowledge. But with the rise of modernity, religion has become overwhelmingly associated with and bound by the notion of belief, not knowledge. And philosophy, for all of its strength, it's hard to say that it's really expanded our knowledge of the natural world, of the mind, or anything else, because philosophers, for the whole history of Western philosophy, continue to make a habit of disagreeing with each other. Rather than coming to consensual knowledge and building on it, like the scientists, philosophers tend to engage in much more analysis, speculation, and so forth. So we don't see in religion and in philosophy over the last 400 years a growth of consensual knowledge as we do in science. And this can lead one to believe that within religion, philosophy, and science is the only avenue that really gives rise to greater and greater knowledge. So this, in part, this is a major reason why science, focusing on the physical, has given us a materialistic vision of the universe. Not because science itself is materialistic, but the scientists, as scientists, have focused on the material, and they've learned something. Whereas religious people and philosophers, it's hard to see if they come up with consensual knowledge. And this is why I feel very passionately that the great contemplative traditions, which are experiential, that are largely rational, and have made tremendous discoveries about the nature of the mind, the nature of consciousness itself, this needs to be brushed off. It needs to be brought out to the bright light of modernity so that we can see there are these complementary modes of inquiring into the nature of reality by way of science, looking externally into the objective world, and what I call contemplative science, which means primarily looking into the nature of the mind, not just with belief or ritual or dogma, but rather in the sense of what William James called radical empiricism, really probe right into the nature of the mind, into multiple dimensions of consciousness, and find here is a true fitting partner for scientific inquiry. Scientific and contemplative together will give us a much fuller three-dimensional vision of reality, whereas focusing on the objective, the physical alone, gives us, frankly, a pretty flat vision of reality, where everything that's said to exist is boiled down to just matter and the emergent properties of matter. And to my mind, and I feel this very strongly, this gives us a terribly impoverished vision of reality as a whole if all that we take seriously, real is that which can be measured physically. All of our subjective experience, our hopes, dreams, joys, sorrows, fears, our virtues, our wisdom, none of these are physical, none of these are quantifiable, and subjective experience, frankly, is left out of the scientific paradigm, except insofar as simply equated with brain function, which is one more hypothesis that does not have compelling empirical evidence to support it.
Nor are they going to get the empirical evidence using the same methodology based on physical measurement in the scientific materialist principles, correct? So we need a new, as it's been developing, a new science that is more able to measure subtle phenomena of consciousness.
Well, this is it. You know, if one's methodology for studying the mind is entirely physical, that is, you're just studying the brain and behavior, then it's a foregone conclusion that everything you say about the mind is going to suggest that it's physical, because this is built into the limitations of your methodology. It's kind of like a joke, really.
The scientists have somehow shown
that the mind is simply the brain or an emergent property or function of the brain is a joke, because all they know is how to study the physical and the objective. So what other conclusion could they possibly draw, given the limitations of this methodology, other than that the mind conforms to their own objective, their own materialistic biases? So this is pseudoscience, frankly, even though it's very widespread. But simply to assume that consciousness and the mind are nothing more than functions or properties of the brain is not a scientific statement at all. It's just an expression of a metaphysical bias that underlies and precedes scientific inquiry, rather than being a genuine discovery, which science has made in so many, many other areas.
That's so well said. So, Alan, then translate that for our listeners, please. How does that affect the medicine that West presents us with?
I'm sorry, there's a bit of static. Can you ask the question again, please?
Yes, sure. How does that then, in translating this for our listeners, how does that then affect the medicine that Westerners are presented with?
The medicine? As a medical treatment?
Yes, the medical system based on our science. How does that then translate into what we're offered from our medical system?
Right. Well, this is, again, is a complicated area, because modern medicine is very much part or is embedded in the modern scientific paradigm. And the modern scientific paradigm is embedded in the metaphysical assumptions of materialism, which suggests that what we are as human beings is really a physical body that includes, of course, the brain, and the function, one of the functions of the brain is to produce states of consciousness, mental activities, and so forth and so on. So for all the strengths of this kind of materialistic approach to understanding the body, which, of course, is physical, there's a limitation here when one equates all the states of consciousness as being nothing more than brain states. It's a severe limitation, and where I find it frankly tragic is when one assumes that all psychological problems are really nothing more than neurological disorders. This is very limiting. And so if this is when we have mental problems, and we're told that these are nothing more than brain disorders, then the immediate implication is, okay, find the right drug, probably, first of all, the right drug, maybe some surgical intervention, and fix the machine that's broken, that's manifesting the symptoms of mental problems. But what psychiatrists have found, and the pharmaceutical industry would perhaps like us not to focus on too clearly, is that this wide array of psychopharmaceutical drugs, in almost all cases, heal nothing when it comes to mental disorders. They manage the symptoms. They suppress the symptoms. But when it's going to heal the mind of imbalances, of neuroses, of psychoses, drugs have a place for sure. I don't want to be a fanatic or an extremist here, but if one is going for a cure, one should be looking also into causal agency within the mind and not always just looking at neurons, chemical imbalances in the brain, and so forth. So once again, this calls for balance, not pitting sciences versus religion or spirituality versus science, but rather looking for a much more holistic or more integrated way of understanding mental health, physical health, that includes the subjective, which is not quantifiable and which is not physically measurable, together with brain function, genetics, and so forth, which, of course, have a very important role in understanding our well-being as well as mental and psychological disorders.
Okay, so you brought up William James, and that was my first major in college, was psychology, and I found it devoid of everything that makes humans humans and found it entirely too mechanical, and I left that major in my third semester, leading me to who I've become today, very much so. And William James is part of a tradition that's still attached to Western science, even though it's the West's version of attempting to study the mind, it still remains steeped in the premises of scientific materialism and the materialist approach. So again, there's the limitation you're speaking of. Where, if anywhere, in our Western tradition do you see hope for understanding?
I see hope, especially in the younger generation. That is, people of my generation, I'm in my 50s now, who are in the scientific community. I mean, certainly there are quite a number of them who are open-minded, but overall, they've invested their professional lives within the system, within the institutionalization of science, which is massively dominated by the largely unquestioned beliefs of materialism. And so if you've invested your whole professional life in this, you're not going to be too much interested or inspired to question the basis of your whole professional life, that is, to question these assumptions of scientific materialism. The younger generation, young people in their undergraduate work and graduate work, who have not yet been fully, let's say, brainwashed into this dogma of scientific materialism, I'm finding a growing number of them are looking for something sensible, that's rational, that's experientially based. And so I find there's a lot of hope there. And we find brilliant people like William James, who is so non-dogmatic. He's really one of the least dogmatic of all the great thinkers of the Western tradition. And he was so multifaceted. He was a profound philosopher. He was a psychologist. He wrote a brilliant text on religious experience. And he did strongly emphasize, take a radically empirical approach to studying the mind, relying first, foremost, and always on introspection. Of course, he didn't have sophisticated means for developing introspection, for developing attention skills and so forth. They just weren't available, and he couldn't do everything himself. But unfortunately, this wonderfully empirical, open-minded, and non-dogmatic approach to studying the mind, states of consciousness, and for that matter, the whole bandwidth of religious experience, this whole approach that he adopted and promoted, this was largely buried with his death in 1910, especially in the United States. It was buried by the rise of a new school which was completely antithetical to his, and that was the school of behaviorism. And specifically radical behaviorism, like that of promoted by B.F. Skinner, subjective experience is almost dismissed to the point of non-existence. And there are neuroscientists and philosophers even to this day who barely want to acknowledge that subjective experience even exists. They want to focus everything on the brain and behavior. And this, I just have to say, has profoundly impoverished our understanding of human nature, the nature of the mind, the potentials of the mind. And so it's high time, and I think it's high time to balance this out, to correct this terrible imbalance, which has been dominating the mind sciences for 100 years now. And so I'm looking to the younger generation who are maybe very interested in yoga, interested in meditation, interested in philosophy, interested in the mind, but not willing to buy into the whole dogma of science and materialism, but are really willing to challenge this. And they're not too deeply into their careers, not too much invested in the dominating paradigm, that they're intimidated by asking these questions. Frankly, I think a lot of philosophers and scientists in the Mayan sciences today don't dare ask any questions outside the box because they'll be ridiculed. They'll be, in a manner of speaking, excommunicated in terms of publishing in peer-reviewed scientific journals and so forth. So I'm looking to the next generation to give them all the encouragement and support I can, not again to suggest follow religion rather than science, but scrape off these barnacles of dogma that are hindering the scientific imagination. And one knife you can use is use the knife of sharp, rigorous contemplative inquiry through the refinement of the attention, of introspection, of mindfulness. So in this regard, I find great hope.
Oh, that's so good to hear. I'm doing that myself. I was in Asia for the 10 years studying subtle energies and cultivating my own subtle energy system and meditation practice much, much more in depth from being in the place where it came from in my yoga practice as well and becoming a teacher. And so here I am back in the States sharing this information about the imbalance where we're impoverished in our Western system. And I find, Alan, that it's a different concept over here of the average person's view of what meditation is, whereas what you're saying is the accurate view of it, that it is a systematic, scientific approach to studying the mind. And is it not? Wouldn't we call meditation naturalistic observation in the Western scientific model?
It certainly can be. And this is one reason I was willing to interrupt my retreat here. It's a six-month solitary retreat to speak with you on air, because I find the popular media, this is the major newspapers, the major news networks, the internet networks of news dissemination, that even the science writers, I'm really quite dismayed to see that really, with almost no exceptions, they're unwilling or simply not aware of the possibility of questioning the dominant scientific paradigm of materialism. That is, I love science. I've engaged in many, many scientific research projects with leading scientists around this country and in Europe. So I love science, tremendously respect it, but I don't love dogmatism. Whether it crops up in science or religion, I find in both places it's equally abhorrent and terribly destructive. And so meditation, this is where it needs to get out into the public, that meditation is not simply a relaxation technique. It's not just to make you mindful, to make you more productive, to develop greater emotional balance and so forth, but meditation as the cultivation of the mind, and one may begin with the cultivation of attention, which is frankly a great strength of classical India and a great weakness of the modern West. Start with the cultivation of attention and see if you can use like a very well-mounted telescope with well-polished, focused lenses, gazing deep into the heavens to observe the moon, the stars, the planets, and so forth. Develop a telescope-like samadhi, or highly focused, clear, and stable attention, so that you can focus on states of consciousness, mental energetic memories, dreams, learn how to dream lucidly, that is, be aware that you're dreaming while you're dreaming, and open up a whole world of exploration that you simply cannot access if you limit your inquiry into the nature of the mind by studying just brain and behavior. These are handcuffs. This is a straitjacket that's terribly limiting scientific inquiry into the nature of the mind because it's flat, it's two-dimensional.
Were you with the Dalai Lama as it was starting the Mind Life Institute and the summits that he had with his team of Tibetan monks and the Western scientists to help start the measurement of the effects of meditation?
Yes, in 1987 we had our first Mind and Life meeting with the Dalai Lama. He's been my teacher since my spiritual mentor since 1971. I was ordained by him, and for many years, off and on, served as his interpreter, especially when he met with scientists. So we held our first Buddhism and Science meeting, sponsored by the Mind and Life Institute in 1987. And I was invited to serve as a co-interpreter together with a wonderful Tibetan scholar who's wonderfully fluent in English. And so that was the first, now more than 20 such meetings between the Dalai Lama and world-class scientists in the field of biology, of chemistry, of physics especially, as well as Western philosophers. So this has been a very meaningful ongoing dialogue, and has given rise to some very fruitful research as well, not just talking and books coming out of these conferences, but also research. And I've participated in a good deal of this research over the last 20 years or so.
Yep. You want to talk about some of that with the Shamanta research?
Yeah, well, about, what was it now, 5 years ago, or actually it was 8 years ago, I was thinking, having trained a lot in shamatha. Now, shamatha is simply a mode of meditation, or kind of a class of meditation, not a school, but a type of meditation which is specifically designed to cultivate attention skills. And as I mentioned before, has to do with cultivating relaxation, stability, and vividness of attention. So I was very familiar with this such practice. I'd spent years practicing it in solitary retreat. And so 8 years ago, I thought, you know, this approach to meditation, which is utterly not non-dogmatic, doesn't entail buying into any belief system, religious or materialistic, this could be a very good thing to study scientifically because it's so transparent and the benefits also are very evident. So I approached a colleague of mine, a neuroscientist at the University of California at Davis, and said, would you like to develop a scientific research project to study the effects of sustained intensive training in shamatha? His name is Cliff Sarin, an old friend of mine with whom we'd engaged in collaborative research 20 years ago in India. And he said, sure, let's go for it. So we spent 3 years in preparation, and what we came up with was thus far the largest scientific study of meditation ever done. They're still crunching the 22 terabytes of data that were generated by studying about roughly 70 people in two groups of about 35 each who spent three months in intensive meditative training under my guidance up in at a retreat center in the Rocky Mountains. And so they were looking at physiological effects, psychological effects. And so what they found is that this training was tremendously beneficial in some expected ways, that is in terms of developing a greater sense of well-being, meaning in life, of course, attention skills, but also empathy, altruism, compassion. But they found also some very, very interesting and very positive physiological effects as well. So this is one very large scientific research project that I actually initiated and I've been involved with ever since, still reviewing and contributing to the various scientific papers coming out of this one study. There's another one called Cultivating Emotional Balance that was inspired by Paul Ekman, an outstanding affective psychologist, again coming out of a mind and life meeting, this one with the Dalai Lama in the year 2000. Yep. And he asked me to join him in developing this. So this too, without going on and on, this too became a scientific study. The results, once again, were very, very good. And as you mentioned earlier on in this program, even a relatively short period of meditation, you mentioned 12 minutes, perhaps extend that to 20 minutes, even a little bit of meditation each day can have very measurable, experientiable effects that are very beneficial to body and mind. And we've demonstrated this in the shamatha project, in the scientific study, but also in this cultivating emotional balance study, which is now being disseminated all over the world. I've worked with Paul Ekman and his daughter to teach trainers of this cultivating emotional balance, and we continue to do this each summer.
I'm going to have to hook up with you for that, Alan. I was fascinated, and I actually worked with the Mind Life transcripts that became documents, I mean the books, in as my text in my global psychology class that I taught to high school students prior to then transitioning into teaching AP psychology. And I had to work with both the Psychology 101 textbook that they use at the college level and then brought in the Mind Life transcripts in the text forms. And I did not realize you were co-interpreter of the very first one. And I am so impressed with that work with the Mind Life Institute because it's the exact approach that you were talking about and the intention behind my coming back to the States when I did, doing the work and making the personal investment of my time and money and energy to helping to get this information out there, dispelling the myths and showing the tangible, effective changes that happen in a person's life when we're not assumed under this sometimes oppressive presentation that the life that we live is only based in the material, and that's what's important. And when we can see something and feel something and then believe it, then that's when we believe in something, as opposed to living in Asia for the 10 years in a culture exposed primarily to the Chinese and then the Thais and then the Indians, that each system of the three to varying degrees, but still being in the East, value the subtle energies or that which is invisible, and it is written into their culture's paradigm as dominantly as physicalness, and the material is written into our culture's paradigm as dominant as it is. So what the Dalai Lama's summits, those biennial summits, did for me was, oh my God, I was so grateful there were others in leading the way, and I could use the material to help with what my intention was. And the then outcomes of the summits, where I remember one in particular where the Dalai Lama was saying, these are the found results we have found through the centuries of meditation. And the panel, a couple of the scientists said, no, the Dalai Lama said, give me a lab and I'll prove it. And a couple of scientists offered theirs. And I think this first study went to Richard Davidson up at the University of Madison, Wisconsin. I'm so grateful to you and the Dalai Lama and all of the scientists and, how do I say, Geshe's that were on his team.
I missed the word. Who are on his team?
G-E-S-H-E, the Tibetan monk.
Geshe's. These are highly trained Tibetan monks. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm so grateful. Geshe's?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, thank you.
I think we probably have you're watching the clock, I'm sure. But before we close, I'd like to mention something exactly along these lines, and that is, while neuroscience labs, including Richard Davidson's and others in Europe and elsewhere in this country, are really drawing from their own strengths, which is exactly what they should be doing, and that is drawing on, you know, the objective study of the brain, the behavior, and so forth, what the Dalai Lama has proposed, and he's asked me to work very closely with him, is to develop something that is really not found anywhere else in the world, and that still doesn't exist. That is a truly scientific but also profoundly contemplative institute for the contemplative inquiry in the nature of the mind by highly trained individuals from multiple traditions, and then inviting to the table also highly trained scientists. And the Dalai Lama has proposed, this is his suggestion, that we create such a center in Bangalore, India, which is one of the more progressive, prosperous regions of South Central India, that will be ecumenical in the sense that contemplatives from multiple traditions will be invited to come there to engage in sustained contemplative research, but also this is really the hub or one of the hubs of science in India, and invite top-notch Indian and other neuroscientists, psychologists, philosophers, other types of scientists to collaboratively draw from these complementary modes of inquiry, the scientific and the contemplative, to give us a much richer and, again, fully three-dimensional understanding of the mind and its potentials. So we are seeking to create such a center, a contemplative and a scientific research center for the study of the mind in Bangalore, and I would love to see something like that be created here in the West, for example, right here in Santa Barbara. It's a dream of mine, not yet realized, but this is something, once again, that would be a bridge between these two cultures that you've seen. And I think it's all the more important in this modern world. You mentioned Thailand, India, and China, but bear in mind that academia in India actually is very strongly dominated by the materialistic beliefs of modern science. Of course, this is true in China, communist China. Materialism dominates everything. And even in a largely Buddhist country like Thailand, again, the materialistic paradigm that is kind of like a virus that goes together with the living organism of science is still very influential. So with the rise of modern science 400 years ago, this community of natural philosophers or scientists did us, Western civilization, a great service in introducing an element of radical empiricism, of careful observation, to dispel a lot of the superstitions that were, how do you say, baggage carried by the religious traditions of the West, to scrape those off and bring in the sharp light of empiricism and rationality. So in that regard, modern science did a great service, not only to Europe, but over the course of time, to the entire world, by challenging and often banishing the superstitions of earlier traditions, including religious ones. But now the table is turned. And frankly, to be very blunt, I think the most dominant superstition of the modern era is the belief that all that exists in the universe is material phenomena and their emergent properties. In other words, the dark materialism, which once again is like a virus that goes along with the living organism of modern science. So the contemplative traditions of the world, including those of Thailand, of China, of India, and for that matter, the West, the Christian tradition, the Jewish tradition, contemplative traditions, these can now sort of provide a service to the scientific tradition to help banish the superstitions that have grown up in modern science, namely the superstition of the dogma of materialism. Banish that. Let the scientific community breathe the fresh air of radical empiricism, and in so doing, then we'll find common ground between contemplative and profoundly religious inquiry on the one hand and scientific inquiry on the other. It will be very, very healing, and this is my passionate hope for humanity.
Alan, yes. I feel like, from my research, the reaction to go into studying the material was out of this irrationality view during the Dark Ages, and we have just swung so far over to, don't look at the subjective, no, we can't trust it, only trust the objective and the material, that this is where we are now today. The pendulum has swung too far over.
The first book that I wrote on this topic is called, I published it with, 13 years ago with the University of Oxford, Oxford University Press, called The Taboo of Subjectivity. And it addresses exactly that issue, that subjectivity, subjective experience, the nature of consciousness, frankly, is simply left out, marginalized, or flattened, or reduced to the physical in the modern scientific vision of reality. And this is like looking at reality with one eye closed. You get a two-dimensional vision. We need to open up the other eye, the eye of contemplative vision, the eye of wisdom. And by coupling this, conjoining this with the eye of scientific scrutiny of the objective, rational, empirical strength of modern science, with these two eyes, the contemplative and the scientific, I think we will see, like we've never seen before, a rich and fully three-dimensional vision of the universe at large and human nature in particular.
So, Alan, what is your project right now? If somebody wants to work with you, where do they go? Your contact information is on this page. Excuse me. Let me just get more clear. Your contact information is on this page. If you click on guest info, you can get both his links. It's also on the bottom right of this page that you guys are on to view and listen to this show. It says the contact information for B. Alan Wallace is here, and there's two different websites there. Dr. Wallace's own website, and then the Santa Barbara Institute for Consciousness Studies. So if you want to get in touch with them, the information is down there. And what are you doing that people can come in and work with you?
Well, not right now, I'm in solitary retreat apart from this conversation, but I'll be coming out in June, and I have a very full teaching schedule for the latter half of this year and then on into next year. But as I mentioned briefly before, as the Dalai Lama would love to see and is really supporting the creation of a truly scientific and truly contemplative research center in India for their exploration, especially of the nature of the mind, I would love to see a brother-sister relationship between the center the Dalai Lama would like to create in India and create one here in North America. And since I live in Santa Barbara, why not here? But such a facility for very rigorous, top-notch scientific inquiry, but together with highly professional contemplative inquiry, the two conjoined, and looking for then the practical benefits for understanding mental health, for understanding mental disease, for the practical applications in business, in medicine, and education, even in athletics, to see how the cultivation of the mind might improve one's athletic prowess. So such a mind center, I think, would be a great boon. And then I've been training individuals now for a number of years who are devoting themselves to months or even years of single-pointed, full-time contemplative practice. And it would be wonderful to create what I call contemplative observatories, at least one, for example, here in North America, where people can devote themselves to months or even years as researchers, devoting themselves, as I am right now, meditating about 12 hours a day, week after week, month after month. And so that these are the real researchers, just as we have neuroscience researchers, we have astronomers, we have physicists, and so forth. researches into the nature and potentials of consciousness through first-person, radically empirical inquiry. And so the creation of such contemplative observatories where people can live very frugally, very simply, in a quiet and conducive environment, I think this would be a generation of researchers that would be a tremendous, companions, counterparts, collaborators with modern scientists who are also open-mindedly interested in the nature of the mind. So anybody who would like to collaborate with me, it's not something I want to feel I need to be in charge of, but I would certainly love to contribute to help see such a mind center and such contemplative observatories created so that we can bring much greater depth, clarity, wisdom, and compassion to the study of the mind.
You can contact him with the information already discussed. Is it brilliant? Aren't we blessed to have had an hour of his time where he pulls himself out of that solitary retreat to be with us? Thank you so much, Dr. B. Allen Wallace. You are a gift to this planet. Thank you for being you.
Allison, thank you for having me on the air. I'm glad to share with you. And this may there be benefit. This is my aspiration. May there be benefit. May there be much benefit for humanity.
Indeed. Blessings to you, sir. Thank you again for your time. Be in touch.
Thank you for joining us and allowing yourself this time to expand and become more of who you're here to be. Dr. K has a range of different offerings of her vibrational upgrades at all price points, including free. So for more information, please go to www.alisonjk.com. Dr. K's first book, What If There's Nothing Wrong, is available on Amazon.com. Dr. K also has a weekly clearing and activation call that is attended by her most advanced clients and students, an important activity in keeping themselves aligned and their vibration high. We'd love to have you come and play. Om Shanti.